Chapter 31. According to journalist Johnny Whiteside, Johnny Ray's biographer, as noted, for the book Cry, Dorothy Kilgallen had connected Lee Harvey Oswald with Carlos Marcello. Dorothy was in high gear working on the Kennedy assassination, an investigation that demanded more and more of her time. To Johnny, it all seemed quite mysterious. She mentioned a planned trip to New Orleans for further research into Lee Harvey Oswald's background and connections there, a daunting contradiction of his pro-Cuba street-corner politics and incongruous associations with right-wing conservatives and the Carlos Marcello crime family. Kilgallen, who had early on written a column entitled DA to Link Ruby to Oswald, must have suspected, after interviewing Ruby and learning of his actions before he shot Oswald, that Carlos Marcello was involved. She did not travel to Washington, D.C. to investigate the CIA or the military establishment, did not return to Dallas to investigate LBJ, and did not investigate possible Cuban involvement in JFK's death, but instead had traveled to New Orleans and intended to do so again. That Ruby was connected to Marcello was later noted in the House Select Committee on Assassinations report. An excerpt read, FBI records indicated Jack Ruby called Nofio Pecora, a capo working for Marcello, 3 weeks before November 22, 1963. Also, Ruby, Kilgallen would have known, could not have operated a strip club in Dallas without Marcello's okay, since, through Joe Campisi and Joe Civello, the Mafia Don's empire stretched to Dallas. In addition, Kilgallen knew the background of why Marcello was the logical suspect to have orchestrated the JFK assassination. The motive was based on revenge. Revenge for the humiliation the mobster had experienced when Bobby ordered him deported to the jungles of Guatemala and then, as noted, when he returned, charging him with racketeering. This information had to have led to her belief that there was not really a conspiracy, but a true mob hit start to finish, with even Melvin Belly part of the plan, since he had been ordered to silence Jack Ruby while making him appear crazy. Here, Kilgallen had the advantage, since she watched firsthand as Belly threw the Ruby case like a punch-drunk fighter who goes through the motions but ends up flat on his back. Only it was Ruby who went down for the count, being sentenced, as he was, to death. Kilgallen, as smart as she was, as smart as any prosecutor or defense attorney, must have surmised that when Ruby was recruited to kill Oswald, those who ordered the hit hoped for the best result possible, that Ruby would close Oswald's mouth and, when he did, the police would shoot Ruby and he'd be dead as well, closing another loophole. But when he was arrested instead of shot, Belly had to be the savior to terminate the final loose end surviving the assassination of JFK. Recall Belly stating, after he heard that Oswald was dead, "Now I'll have to defend Ruby," the strongest evidence that he may have been privy to Ruby waiting in the wings to silence Oswald. Connecting all the dots in this plausible, common-sense scenario leads to a chain reaction of events that, in all likelihood, looked like this. Joseph Kennedy double-crosses the Mafia, who helped JFK become president after the 1960 election by forcing JFK to appoint RFK Attorney General, who, in turn, hounds certain mafiosos, including Carlos Marcello, deportation and arrest. Marcello orchestrates JFK assassination to render RFK powerless. Lee Harvey Oswald, part of plot but not acting alone, is captured. Joe Campisi, under orders from Marcello, orders Ruby to kill Oswald. Ruby arrested after shooting Oswald. Marcello's sidekick, Mickey Cohen, contacts Belly to represent Ruby. Belly shuts Ruby up at trial by not letting him testify while making him look crazy. Mobsters never pursued again by RFK. He finally resigns to run for Senate. One reliable first-hand account confirming the Marcello connection comes from a primary source, Ronald Goldfarb, a Washington, D.C. attorney who worked for Robert Kennedy in the Justice Department's Organized Crime Section from 1961 to 1964. His disclosures provide great insight into the mindset of RFK shortly after becoming Attorney General. In a 1993 Washington Post editorial, Goldfarb wrote, "The link between Marcello and the murder of JFK is based on much more than idle speculation. Robert Kennedy's chief and abiding interest as Attorney General was organized crime. As soon as he took office, he sought legislation and resources to wage an unprecedented legal war on racketeers. He set up a special organized crime section in the criminal division and recruited an elite staff of lawyers to fight the battle." Goldfarb added, "As part of our strategy, we developed a list of the top 40 racketeers in the country, and each of us was assigned responsibility for a person or area of the country. If not the mafia boss, Marcello certainly was one of the top bosses. John Duguid, a young member of our new group, was assigned several southeastern states, including Louisiana. At one of our first regular morning meetings, Kennedy questioned Duguid about the status of the Marcello investigations and his long-pending deportation case." Authors note, Goldfarb's account of the development of a list of 40 racketeers and Marcello's name being on that list is confirmed in the HSCA report previously mentioned, adding to his credibility. Goldfarb then chronicled Marcello's birth in Tunis, Tunisia in 1910 of Italian parents, and his various legal operations pointing to a New Orleans empire totaling earnings of more than $1 billion per year, before adding, "If Marcello was going to be tough and ingenious, Kennedy would be the same. In 1961, Kennedy moved to deport Marcello as a Guatemalan, a decision carried out in a highly questionable manner. On April 4, 1961, Marcello was arrested, handcuffed, whisked away to the New Orleans airport, not allowed to call anyone, and flown to Guatemala City on a government plane. He had been shanghaied, denied notice or hearing." While Giancana, Cohen, Costello, and Trafficante looked on, RFK's relentless pursuit of Marcello, who had embarrassed Bobby by re-entering the U.S. after being deported, continued. When Marcello re-entered the United States, Goldfarb wrote that RFK attempted to deport him again while charging the mobster with racketeering, before stating that, during Marcello's trial in New Orleans, his associate, David Ferry, was often in the courtroom. "He is the same David Ferry who shadowed Duguid in Guatemala and that New Orleans D.A. Jim Garrison later charged had been involved in the events leading up to the Kennedy assassination." Regarding the trial, the power of Marcello caused Goldfarb to write, "Eventually there was proof that tied juror payoffs to Marcello, right down to pictures of four jurors cashing checks traceable to Marcello. The four bribed jurors were given immunity and testified, admitting they received the bribes." Goldfarb then confirmed that despite this evidence, Marcello was acquitted after word of JFK's assassination was reported by the judge in front of the jury, who must have realized that Marcello may have been involved and thus they wanted no part of offending him with a guilty verdict. Goldfarb then boldly stated, "There is no question Marcello hated Robert Kennedy. At a September 1962 meeting at Marcello's farm, Marcello blurted a Sicilian curse of revenge at Kennedy. Translated, it meant, 'Get that stone out of my shoe.' According to one account of that meeting, Marcello raged, 'Don't worry about that little Bobby son of a bitch. He's going to be taken care of.'" The attorney, present when all of these developments happened, then agreed with the House Select Committee on Assassinations' conclusion. Marcello had the motive, means, and opportunity to plan and execute a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. As the fall of 1963 approached, Marcello's back was against the wall. He had exhausted every deportation appeal. He faced the conspiracy charges trial. Considerable prison time was possible if convicted. Desperate, with no way out, his freedom and multi-million-dollar empire at risk, the Don had no choice but to take action, with the only question being whether to eliminate Bobby, his chief nemesis, or the president. Why kill John Kennedy instead of Bobby, whom Marcello despised? Simple common sense dictates that the clever mafioso knew if he eliminated Bobby, JFK would use all of the government's resources to come after him. However, if JFK was assassinated, then RFK would be rendered powerless. Predictably, this was exactly what happened. Within a short time after JFK was dead, a victim of his father and brother's poisonous misdeeds, not JFK's own, RFK disbanded the Justice Department's Organized Crime Division, specifically intended to put mobsters like Marcello out of business and in prison if possible. In fact, Marcello went free until the early 1980s, long after RFK was dead and gone. According to Kent Frenchy Bruyette, a sinister character in the New Orleans underworld, he met Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans on several occasions, and specifically in Marcello's office shortly before the assassination. Bruyette's account is chilling and confirmed by respected author Matthew Randazzo in his book Mr. New Orleans. He quotes Bruyette as stating, "I come from the same New Orleans traditions as the pirates Jean and Pierre Lafitte. Though I wouldn't put myself in the same category as the Lafittes, my associates included three men who could go toe-to-toe with them any day. New York's Frank Costello, New Orleans' own Carlos Marcello, and Silvestro Silver Dollar Sam Carollo." Regarding his introduction to Costello, with whom Kilgallen had been on friendly terms in NYC, Bruyette said, "The small, aging, big-nosed gentleman who extended his hand to me was the meekest and most unobtrusive person I had met in big-talking, cocking New Orleans. He looked like a professor or an IRS agent in a narrow, tailored suit. I was eye to eye with Frank Costello. It was in the spring of 1963 that a plan to kill JFK supposedly took shape. The architects included Marcello and Trafficante. My first Oswald sighting came in Carlos's office at the Pelican Tomato Company, a small vegetable wholesaling company run by his mafia confidant, Joe Baby Matassa. I was unprepared for the shock I felt when I found Carlos sitting there with Oswald." Bruyette added, "After that meeting at the Pelican Tomato Company, it seemed like I couldn't go anywhere without running into goddamn Lee Harvey Oswald." As far as Oswald went, Bruyette recalled, he was just a patsy in the assassination. They had assurance they would be able to get rid of him real quick since Dallas was Carlos's town. Jack Ruby was the perfect solution, a Chicago mob guy with ties to Carlos who was a police station hangaround. They pay him off, lean on him a bit, and he whacks Oswald. That ties everything up with a bow." Bruyette's description of Marcello's empire also coincides with a primary source who contacted this author in May 2020. Requesting anonymity due to possible harm if her identity was known even six decades later, she described how Marcello, whose official business address was at the Town and Country Motel at 1225 Airline Highway in New Orleans, had smothered the New Orleans area with his mob infiltration. She began by making the bold statement, "I am very much aware that Carlos Marcello masterminded the assassination of JFK." The woman we will call Angela then provided elements of her background, that she grew up around mafia families, and that the children in those families were not reticent about sharing underworld stories involving their fathers. Angela added, "Money laundering restaurants and betting parlors owned by the Marcello family around Jefferson Parish handled that part of the business. She said a family member of hers handled bets on horses and ball games with bookies close to New Orleans. Among Marcello's businesses were Guy's Pool Hall in Harvey, Louisiana, and West Bank Bowling Lanes in Gretna, and Marcello controlled all of these spots, providing cash flow for his other operations. Other Marcello-controlled businesses were bars, Angela said, in Harvey, Westwego, Luling, Harahan, Mandeville, and Metairie. Those who crossed the line and offended Marcello, whom a close friend described as a short man, very well dressed, had power through his reputation, by attempting to cheat him or switch allegiance to other underworld figures, took a severe risk. Angela said that one guy living in Gretna ran a card game out of his house. One night, Marcello's men paid him a visit since they thought he was holding out on them. Those men roughed the guy up and then tore apart his house looking for money. Regarding Marcello's penchant for violence, Angela told this author, "If you were to cross this man, you would pay for your carelessness." Of course, he took revenge on getting dropped off in Colombia, Guatemala, after being kidnapped. He had to in order to maintain respect. Respect was everything with him. Substantiation for Angela's claims regarding the location of Marcello's business interests appears in Frenchy Bruyette's accounts in the book Mr. New Orleans. On page 57, he wrote, "You couldn't do a damn thing illegally in Jefferson Parish without Carlos. His cronies infested the parish government and police department, allowing soldiers to establish local criminal monopolies in all of Jefferson's towns." He then listed them as Metairie, Gretna, Kenny, Terrytown, Grand Isle, Avondale, Westwego, Marrero, Harvey, and Jean Lafitte. Frenchie's claims, and thus Angela's, appear to be valid based on further shocking facts revealed in the 2019 book Hollywood Godfather, written, as previously mentioned, by former Frank Costello associate Gianni Russo. Finally able to divulge the shocking events that happened during his life of crime, since most or all of the dangerous men he had dealt with were dead, Russo unleashed a bold account of the workings of the underworld. Whether Dorothy Kilgallen knew of Russo is unknown, but certainly her friendship with mobster Frank Costello, who became Russo's mentor when he first joined the mob as a teenager, lends credence to the fact that she may have been aware of his presence. Russo said Costello became the model for Don Corleone in the book The Godfather, and of reference to the three films based on the book. In the book, Russo, who confirmed that Joe Kennedy had made a deal with the devil with his underworld contacts through Kennedy friend Frank Sinatra in order to win the 1960 presidential election, and then double-crossed the gangsters by allowing RFK to pursue them, recalled what happened on November 19, 1963, just 3 days before John F. Kennedy was assassinated. According to Russo, the mobster said to him during a meeting at New York City's Waldorf Astoria, "I want you to take this to the little man," while sliding a sealed envelope and airline tickets across the table. Russo further explained that he knew that the little man was New Orleans mob boss Carlos Marcello. Regarding the nickname, Russo said, "He was called that because of his height, not his stature in the organization, which was exemplary." Russo recalled that Costello, who had been quite instrumental in setting up Marcello's billion-dollar illegal domain in New Orleans, told him that after Russo gave the envelope to Marcello, he would receive a message. Then, Russo said, he was to return to New York City and deliver the message from Marcello to Costello. When Russo arrived in New Orleans, he said he headed straight for Mosca's restaurant in the suburb of Avondale. Marcello was believed, Russo explained, to be a silent partner in the restaurant. Costello's emissary described the scene. The restaurant was empty. It was hours before the dinner crowd would begin arriving. Marcello was seated at a table by himself in the rear of the dining room, a mountain of pasta before him. He was facing the door. Mob guys always face an entrance in a public place. Russo said Marcello was sharply dressed in a gray suit and tie. Russo explained that Marcello recognized him from previous visits and motioned him to the table. Then Russo recalled, "On the way, I passed the men's room on my right. A skinny guy, who looked to be around 25, chose that time to exit the John and nearly collided with me. I sidestepped him, thought nothing of it, and made my way to the table while the beanpole mumbled something and headed for the door. "You got something for me?" Russo recalled Marcello asking, and after Russo replied, "Yes, sir," he handed the Don the envelope Costello had given his courier. Describing the envelope, Russo said, "It was fairly thick, undoubtedly had cash in it, and who knows what else, and I was glad to get rid of it." Then Russo said Marcello smiled and said, "You need to leave here now. Tell Frank it's on." Commenting on the interaction with Marcello, Russo explained, "He was a very nice man, as long as you didn't cross him. The Kennedys would learn that lesson the hard way." As planned, Russo met with Costello the next morning at the Waldorf and delivered the message, "It's on." Then Costello startled Russo by handing him a thick envelope while telling him he was headed on another trip, this time to Barcelona, Spain, on a ship. When Russo asked when he might return to the United States, Costello said, "When do you think?" "When I say you can come back, that's when." The stay in Europe extended to more than 2 years. Russo said the conversation ended with Costello stating, "The trip is for your own good. You'll understand why in a few days. Things will be clearer then." When Russo checked the envelope, he discovered it contained $30,000 in $100 bills, a huge sum at the time. On Friday, November 22, 1963, Russo said he was startled when the words "bulletin" flashed across the screen on a television set in the ship's bar. The news, Russo learned, was that President John F. Kennedy had been assassinated in Dallas. Russo then wrote, "Later that afternoon I witnessed an event that would forever be burned into my memory. Lee Harvey Oswald, the suspected assassin, was paraded past reporters at the Dallas Police Department headquarters. My jaw dropped. Oswald, or his twin brother, was the same skinny guy I had seen exiting the men's room at the restaurant where I'd gone to meet Carlos Marcello." Summing up the startling turn of events, Russo said, "Each time I saw the images of Oswald, I was convinced that the guy I'd seen exiting the men's room in New Orleans was Oswald." Into this nest of dangerous men, into the New Orleans nest where Oswald had been seen with Marcello, marched Kilgallen with Mark Sinclair in tow. There seems little doubt that Marcello must have been monitoring Kilgallen's columns and behavior, since she was a real threat if she exposed his participation in the JFK assassination. During her first visit, something had spooked her, scared her for Sinclair's welfare and for her own. If she had heeded whatever warning signs appeared that danger lurked, she may have avoided death just a short time later as collateral damage based on RFK's obsession with the Mafia Don. No question exists that Marcello had only one main foe as a strong threat to losing his billion-dollar empire, Bobby Kennedy. The details of how the Mafia kingpin was deported, as chronicled in John H. Davis's well-researched book, Mafia Kingfish, indicate how humiliated Marcello must have been at the actions Bobby took against him. The day of future reckoning for the Kennedys was April 4, 1961, the day when the Mafia Don walked into the offices of the Immigration and Naturalization offices in New Orleans to report as an alien, a monthly requirement. Instead of having to wait, as was the usual, he was whisked before a brisk immigration agent, told, "You are a citizen of Guatemala and you are being deported there," and transported by plane to Guatemala City without benefit of a phone call to his attorney. One may only imagine the venom stirring in Marcello's veins as he was treated with such disrespect, but matters worsened when, after he had to pay a $75,000 bribe in Guatemala to be released from jail, he ultimately was then unceremoniously dumped into the wilds of Honduras with little money and no supplies. 17 days later, exhausted, filthy, and in ill health, he managed to get back into civilization, with various conflicting accounts prevailing as to how Marcello was then flown back into the United States. One important point to mention: some have disputed that Joe Kennedy made his deal with the devil, his double cross of a promise that the new Kennedy administration would leave the mafioso who helped JFK attain the White House alone after he became president. Even if this was true, if one looks to the strongest motive for killing JFK to render Bobby powerless, other than that of Lyndon Johnson since he became president, the strongest motive for sure, Marcello's illicit treatment by RFK is a strong contender, since RFK's Justice Department never bothered Marcello or his mafia brethren again following JFK's assassination. As author Davis put it, Carlos Marcello had been humiliated by Robert Kennedy's mode of deporting him, and Kennedy now stood to be humiliated by Marcello's counterattack, a reference to the plot to kill JFK, to take from RFK the man he loved more than any in the world. To be certain, Marcello's honor had been vanquished. He had been embarrassed in front of his fellow underworld figures. Worse, as author Davis reported, the Mafia Don told friends, "Don't talk about that son of a bitch Bobby to me. You know, he's driven my wife effing crazy. All Jackie do is cry all night thinking Kennedy is gonna throw me out of the country again. Bobby is driving my daughters crazy, too. They don't want to lose their daddy." Details of the empire Marcello controlled, what he had at stake, and what he risked losing either by a second and final deportation or through imprisonment, were exposed in The Plot to Kill the President, written by former HSCA counsel G. Robert Blakey and his co-author Richard Billings. Based on primary source research, they concluded that by 1963, the mobster was grossing many millions annually, $500 million from illegal gambling, $100 million from illegal activities in over 1,500 syndicate-connected bars, $8 million from professional burglaries and holdups, $6 million from prostitution, and $400 million from diverse investments. When he wanted to relax, Marcello could enjoy the benefits of the $22 million, 6,500-acre Churchill Farms estate he owned near New Orleans. Since Bobby Kennedy was the chief law enforcement official in the land, he truly believed that men such as Marcello, Traficante, Hoffa, and other mafiosi deserved to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, and this was valid as long as RFK followed the law. But his personal obsession with those he considered scum triggered a belief that he could skirt the very laws he was sworn to uphold. This was especially true when he deported Marcello without due process. If Bobby had simply followed the law instead of abusing his power, JFK would never have been assassinated by Bobby's enemies in 1963. Speaking to RFK's own brand of justice, author Richard D. Mahoney wrote, "To have an attitude where all of RFK's personality pointed to Bobby's chief failing, underestimating his enemies. Certainly this included Carlos Marcello, who was, as described by acclaimed author Nick Pileggi, tough, impossible to seduce, and the kind of Sicilian mafioso you didn't want to turn into an enemy." Splitting hairs over what relationship Kilgallen had with Mickey Cohen's partner and Carlos Marcello's mentor, Frank Costello, is not as important as the fact that she obviously knew him and he knew her. It is certainly plausible to believe that if Carlos Marcello and his band of thugs needed to orchestrate the death of the famous columnist, Costello, a Marcello loyalist who never hesitated to eliminate anyone threatening him or his friends, was the man to do it, either on his own or through an intermediary. He had access to vital information, where Kilgallen lived, her daily habits, and her close friends. Bottom line, logic dictates that if Marcello, or Hoover for that matter, persuaded Costello that Kilgallen needed to be eliminated and her JFK assassination file confiscated and destroyed, Costello, Kilgallen's friend or not, could have set it up. Critics of this scenario may argue that all of this was simply coincidence. They could say, among other things, that Marcello's friend Mickey Cohen just happened to choose his lawyer Melvin Belli to become Jack Ruby's attorney, That Kilgallen and Belly just happened to become fast friends during the Ruby trial, and that Kilgallen just happened to be the only reporter who interviewed Jack Ruby during that trial. They could add that she just happened to be the one who exposed the Ruby Warren Commission report testimony before it was officially released, and that she just happened to be the only serious journalist, to quote Mark Lane, still working on solving the JFK assassination. Skeptics may also argue that Kilgallen just happened to possess a thick file full of 18 months' worth of credible evidence from reliable sources, and that she just happened to tell friends days before her death that her life was in danger and I'm going to crack the case wide open. They'd argue that Kilgallen just happened to be a close friend of mobster Frank Costello, that she just happened to visit New Orleans with Mark Sinclair within a month of her death, where she scared him with warnings about their safety, that Kilgallen just happened to be making plans to visit New Orleans again, which just happened to be Marcello's backyard so as to confirm her having connected Marcello, Oswald, and Ruby. These critics may also suggest that Costello just happened to be Marcello's mentor and good friend, Costello just happened to be connected to Mickey Cohen and Frank Sinatra, as well as Cohen, Belly's client, and that it just happened that her JFK assassination file, packed with her investigation evidence and Ruby interview notes, disappeared forever. They could suggest that Belly just happened to tell his friend Dr. Martin Shore shortly after he learned of Kilgallen's death, "They've killed Dorothy, now they'll go after Ruby," to which Belly just happened to mention later to Secretary Carol Lind upon learning of Ruby's death, "Maybe they injected him with cancer cells." Most revealing is that Kilgallen just happened to die within days or arguably months of cracking the JFK and Oswald assassination cases wide open. Either coincidence or connection, with common sense obviously pointing toward the latter. This conclusion, based on motive, makes sense due to the proven links between Kilgallen and Ruby, Kilgallen and Belly, Kilgallen and Costello, Oswald, Ruby, and Marcello, Ruby and Belly, Belly and Cohen to Marcello and Costello. Those who feared Kilgallen and her JFK assassination file knew what her friend Marlon Swing knew. Kilgallen was a very powerful woman. People don't have any idea of the contacts and power she had. Dorothy had favors she could call in from people all over the world. Kilgallen, in effect, advertised she was on the brink of solving the JFK and Oswald assassinations, based, it seems clear, on the realization she had uncovered a true mafia hit operation, using the word conspiracy to describe it. Recall Mark Sinclair's comment, "I did know from Dorothy, finally, that there was a conspiracy to kill JFK, that it was a group of people, not one. She told me she wouldn't stop the investigation." If Kilgallen told Sinclair, and boasted to others, as mentioned, that she was going to crack the case wide open, she imprinted a bullseye on her back as a likely target by those threatened with exposure due to her JFK and Oswald assassinations investigation. Certainly Mark Sinclair knew of the danger. When he was told those at Goodson Todman Productions, producers of What's My Line, refused to discuss Kilgallen's death, Sinclair wasn't surprised, stating in his videotaped interview, "You could wind up dead." Maybe Kilgallen believed she was invincible. She was certain that because of her high-profile status, of her star power, that no one could touch her. Kilgallen's rival, Liz Smith, in her syndicated column of December 15, 1976, entitled "The Kilgallen Mystery," wrote that Kilgallen told Mark Lane, "I'm going to break this case." When Lane asked her whether she was afraid, she said, "That's all inconsequential. They killed the President of the United States. The governments are not prepared to tell us how it happened or who did it, and I'm going to do everything I can to find out what happened." While Kilgallen soft-pedaled threats, it seems clear that at some point, as the tragic weekend in November approached, Kilgallen changed her mind. Recall that she had told Charles Simpson, "After I have found out now what I know, if the wrong people knew what I know, it would cost me my life." Echoing the danger Kilgallen was experiencing is an exchange between Larry King, who had told this author, it may be recalled, that she was gutsy, and later admitted Kilgallen was a pioneer in radio, television, and the print media, and famed journalist and author Dominic Dunn during the January 25, 2006 Larry King Live program on CNN. A caller asked Dunn, "Have you ever thought about investigating the mysterious death of Dorothy Kilgallen?" After admitting he had only met her twice, Dunn said, "I can't say how I know her, but you know, you're absolutely right. That is a mysterious death." Whereupon King added, "Sure is." Dunn then called Kilgallen a brilliant crime writer and offered this explanation for her death. "I think she had material, something that they didn't want, somebody didn't want to come out." This surely points toward the wrong people Kilgallen had described to Simpson. Dunn confirmed this exchange a few months later in an April 2006 Dominic Dunn's Diary column in Vanity Fair entitled "Gossip Never Dies." He began by writing, "It amazes me how many people remember the mysterious death in 1965 of Dorothy Kilgallen. I hadn't given a thought to the columnist for decades, but a rush of information came out of my mouth as if I had taken something long forgotten out of a storage vault." Calling her a first-rate crime reporter, Dunn then added, "Kilgallen was not a pretty woman. She had an unfortunate chin which robbed her face of beauty. But on opening nights on Broadway and El Morocco and the Stork Club, she projected an aura of glamour with her magnificent evening dresses and jewels. She had power, wit, and a mean streak. Everybody read her columns, and a lot of people were afraid of her." Dunn then chronicled Kilgallen's coverage of the JFK assassination, stating, "With her fame and her contacts, Kilgallen was able to get what was perhaps the only interview Jack Ruby ever gave before he died. Kilgallen told people she was going to break the case, so Ruby must have told her something that someone important didn't want her to print. At least that's my interpretation." Without question, Kilgallen was right, since the someone Dunn mentioned that led to the wrong people apparently did find out what she knew, arguably from someone close to her, possibly a plant who leaked confidential information. Identifying the person who may have been responsible requires, as will be explained, returning to the wrong bed in the wrong bedroom where Kilgallen was found wearing false eyelashes, a hairpiece, and makeup she never wore to bed, to examine whether she was alone or in the company of someone intending to harm her. Before identifying who that someone was, another eyewitness account of the look and mannerisms of Marcello is possible through the perspective of Dave, who, despite it being more than 60 years since he dealt with the Mafia Don, has requested anonymity. He told this author in 2020, "Carlos Marcello was a smaller man, obviously older than me. I was 26 and he was middle-aged. He sat in a chair across from me at some office in an apartment complex he owned, possibly a folding chair, and he showed good posture. Mr. Marcello was personable, aloof, and you knew you had better sit up in your chair when you spoke to him." Dave added, "He reminded me of my father, who also had a receding hairline and eyes that could look right through you. The chairs in the large meeting room were 5 feet apart and facing each other. No one else was allowed in the room when we met with him. He spoke in a soft voice, and he did not exhibit undue emotion, very businesslike." Businesslike Marcello may have been, but Kilgallen's hunch that he had ordered the hit on JFK is confirmed by what RFK said to advisor and speechwriter Richard Goodwin. "I think my brother was killed by the guy from New Orleans." Based on motive, who else could RFK have been referring to other than Marcello? RFK spoke to JFK presidential confidant Ken O'Donnell about the Dallas assassinations. He recalled, "I mentioned the syndicate, the mob, as a possibility. I'm certain RFK thought the mob had been involved. He suspected Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans capo to whom Jack Ruby had ties. The strippers at Ruby's Carousel Club were under the mobster's control. All he kept saying was, 'They should have killed me,' without indicating who they were." Author Nick Pileggi, who wrote the bestseller Wise Guy that became the film Goodfellas, said Marcello was not to be underestimated when it came to revenge. He told this author, "Marcello was Sicilian, but born in Tunisia and grew up with both Sicilian and Arabic vendetta tendencies. He was not a turn-the-other-cheek kind of guy. Fury and revenge were his credo." No wonder Frenchy Bruyette, in the book Mr. New Orleans, had written, "If Carlos had John Kennedy killed, I guarantee you it never disturbed his sleep or bothered his ego." Robert Kennedy Jr. has stated on several occasions that his father believed the evidence was very, very convincing that it was not a lone gunman who shot JFK. One such occasion was when Bobby's son appeared on the Charlie Rose PBS program. Rose asked RFK Jr. if he believed that RFK felt some sense of guilt because he thought there might have been a link between his very aggressive efforts against organized crime. RFK Jr. said his father had investigators do research into the assassination and found that phone records of Oswald and nightclub owner Jack Ruby were like an inventory of mafia leaders the government had been investigating. Recall that after FBI Director Hoover called Bobby and informed him that his brother was dead, Kennedy press aide Ed Guthman, a primary witness, said RFK told him, "There's so much bitterness. I thought they would get one of us, but Jack, after all he had been through, I never worried about it. I never thought it would happen. I thought it would be me. There's been so much bitterness and hatred." In a subsequent interview with journalist David Talbot, Guthman said he was certain RFK used the word "they," not "he," another indication that any semblance of the Oswald alone theory was pure balderdash. John McCone, CIA director in 1961, said in an oral history for the John Lowry Simpson Oral History series, "RFK wanted to know what we knew about it and whether it had been a Cuban or perhaps Russian hit. He even asked me if the CIA could have done it. I mentioned the mob, but RFK didn't want to know about it. I suspect he thought it was the mob. He said, 'They, whoever they were, should have killed me. I'm the one they wanted.' He blamed himself because of all the enemies he had made along the way, and also because he advised his brother to go to Dallas." To former Democratic National Committee Chairman Lawrence O'Brien, just a day or two after JFK was killed, RFK, who began to wear JFK's leather bomber jacket as some sort of tribute, made a startling admission. "I'm sure that little pinko prick, Lee Harvey Oswald, had something to do with it, the assassination, but he certainly didn't mastermind anything. He should have shot me, not Jack. I'm the one who's out to get them." O'Brien, unfortunately, never asked who "them" was. Joan Braden, CIA operative Tom Braden's wife, was another witness to RFK's suspicions about who masterminded JFK's assassination. She recounted to author David Heyman her recollection of meeting with Bobby when he was considering running for the Senate. After noting that he carried on about Jack intermittently wiping away tears, Braden asked whether her husband, because of his CIA experience, might have some idea as to who had been behind Jack's assassination. Bobby suspected such mob figures as Sam Giancana and Carlos Marcello. RFK's reaction to the death of his beloved brother is most revealing. Logically, Bobby's trip into depression had as much to do with personal guilt as it did with the loss of his brother-slash-best friend. Former New York Times Magazine editor-in-chief and author Edward Klein wrote, "Bobby, who could never shake the suspicion that his enemies had retaliated against him by killing his brother, began reading ancient Greek tragedies for consolation. This was understandable, according to David Heyman, who wrote in his biography of RFK, "Bobby's despair was in no small measure a result of survivor's guilt. JFK had been warned of a climate of hatred in Dallas. Moreover, it was RFK who suggested that the president ride through the streets of Dallas in a car without using the specially outfitted bulletproof top. It will give you more contact with the crowd," he had said. In effect, RFK knew the trip was dangerous, that there was a climate of hatred existing in Dallas evidenced by the egg-throwing episodes involving UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson and Senator William Fulbright when they visited the city. The Dallas Morning News, operated by Ted Dealey, who had the altercation with JFK at the White House, had ripped the president and his policies. But despite these red flags, Bobby, ever the big shot, sent his brother into a nest of danger, even though he knew in his heart Dallas wasn't a friendly city toward the president. Heyman then observed, "Bobby's advice to visit Dallas, however, weighed less heavily on him than did his conduct over the whole of his brother's term in office, for he had been the driving force in the Kennedy administration's most aggressive operations. He had pushed the government to hound the mob, to chase down Hoffa, to destroy Castro. He knew that Jack Ruby was a Dallas racketeer connected to the national mafia." When JFK died, the country and his family mourned, but it was Bobby, who enjoyed being called assistant president, who was left to deal with the brunt of the loss of the brother he dearly loved. Authors Gus Russo and Stephen Moulton decided, "The fury that RFK had first aimed at God now seemed to be aimed at himself." They pointed out that Bobby's Catholic beliefs, once precious to him before JFK's death, took a back seat to other works, including those by French author and philosopher Albert Camus, Greek philosophers, and classicist Edith Hamilton, all suggested by Jackie Kennedy. From Hamilton's The Greek Way, the authors noted, RFK selected a passage to remember. "The gods who hated beyond all else the arrogance of power had passed judgment upon them." He also related, Russo and Moulton wrote, to the words of Aeschylus, "All arrogance will reap a harvest rich in tears. God calls men to a heavy reckoning for overweening pride." Biographer Evan Thomas wrote, "Robert Kennedy discovered fate and hubris. He began to wonder if the Kennedy family had somehow overreached, dared too greatly." After mentioning the previous passage in Edith Hamilton's book and how RFK had underlined it, Thomas noted, "The Kennedys were the House of Atreus, noble and doomed, and RFK began to see himself as Agamemnon, the king of Mycenae, whose family experienced evil through a dreadful curse." Much speculation has centered around where Bobby found a comrade in arms to soothe his wounded soul and deal with the guilt that he possessed for setting up his brother for the kill. Stories suggest this comrade in arms, also one suffering, was none other than Jackie Kennedy. Certainly there is strong evidence the grieving brother and JFK's grieving wife spent a great deal of time together, closing ranks and trying to move forward. Of the accounts claiming this friendship became a romance and sexual in nature, the most credible appears to be those included in author David Heyman's book, Bobby and Jackie, A Love Affair. Quoting Charles Chuck Spalding, whom the author called one of JFK's most devoted friends, Heyman recalled an incident during a trip Spalding took with the former First Lady and RFK to Antigua. First, Spalding addressed Bobby's grief, telling Heyman his recollections. "One night we barbecued dinner on the beach. Somebody remarked that Jack Kennedy couldn't tolerate barbecue. Much as he liked it, it invariably upset his stomach. The mere mention of his brother's name sent Bobby into an instant depression. His entire demeanor changed. When she saw this, Jackie went to him, threw her arms around him, and gave him a hug. His face brightened. I couldn't help notice how close they seemed. Spaulding, according to Heyman, then added, "It didn't take much to see that Bobby and Jackie were developing something more than a friendship. They held hands, touched, whispered into each other's ears. There was definitely something between them. You had to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to sense it." Author Heyman quoted film producer Susan Pollock, the two Mrs. Grenvilles, who witnessed Bobby and Jackie together after both of them moved to New York City. She said, "You can look at people and tell if they are intimate. In any case, their affair was an open secret. Everyone knew about it." Heyman also wrote of a trip to Glen Cove, New York, 20 miles from NYC, where, convinced that nobody knew of their romantic involvement, Bobby and Jackie practically flaunted their mutual affection, hugging and kissing on the beach and walking arm in arm to a local restaurant. Without doubt, both J. Edgar Hoover and Carlos Marcello were dangerous men and felt threatened by Kilgallen's evidence possibly being sufficient to trigger a grand jury investigation. Given such powerful enemies, Kilgallen was a dead woman, with the only questions remaining when, where, and how they could murder the dogged reporter. Hoover and Marcello, or their cohorts, wanted up-to-date information about what evidence Kilgallen intended to include in her book for Random House. From her columns, and with a sprinkling of help from those she confided in who were blabbermouths, these powerful men had an idea of the possible devastating accusations she might publish. But what they really needed was a mole, someone within Kilgallen's camp, to give them a heads-up as to what she had in mind based on her investigation. Fortunately, that man would become available, a true Judas to the famous reporter. Such a scenario parallels what Dr. Ralph Greenson may have done when he planted Eunice Murray in Marilyn Monroe's home to spy on her before she died.